Chapter 9. Know their pain. Paint their pain. Work with your adversary's real problem. Your adversary in any negotiation must have vision before they can ever take action. I've said it before, I'll say it again. No vision, no action. No vision, no decision. No vision, no deals that stick. This is Human Nature 101, and it's the subtext, to one extent or another, of much of the preceding material. But what exactly do we need a vision of? Pain. This is what brings every adversary in every negotiation to the table. I realize it's a harsh word, maybe even offensive to some who perhaps feel it makes negotiation and business into a blood sport. I appreciate this concern, but all too often negotiations do become extremely emotional and can require extremely tough decisions. I use pain only as a technical term. It has nothing to do with actual physical pain, although it could certainly lead to that in the form of headaches and upset stomachs. In my system, pain is whatever the negotiator sees as the current or future problem. People make decisions in order to alleviate and take away this current or future problem, this pain. Put in these terms, what else would any negotiation concern? I want to start digging into this subject with a brief history lesson. In my work with clients, I've found that these lessons are a great way to make a couple of points. First, many critical moments in history are really negotiations, if we consider carefully, and we can learn lessons from them that apply to our more mundane endeavors. Second, setting a new principle in a context of great historical importance helps to emphasize the importance of the principle. It gets people's attention. One story from history that gets people's attention is the story of Winston Churchill's brilliant success in getting the attention of the worldwide public in the first days of World War II. On May 13, 1940, after Churchill had become British Prime Minister following the resignation of Neville Chamberlain, whose name has since become synonymous with appeasement, the new leader of the British politely appeared before the House of Commons and was asked for a succinct statement of his wartime policy. His answer, "It is to wage war by sea, land, and air with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny, never surpassed in the dark, lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy." To whom was Churchill directing that remark? With whom was he negotiating? Not with Hitler. To hell with Hitler, literally. No, the new prime minister was negotiating with the constituencies of his potential allies in the democratic West. The free world had been, and still was at that time, little prepared for the massive German industrial and military might that steamrolled Europe. Chamberlain was convinced there was no hope against Hitler's war machine, and he had therefore compromised the British Empire in his efforts to avoid a war he did not think he could win. So it was no surprise that Churchill inherited a constituency that saw no hope. He did have hope, however, and passion and genius, and his problem was how to persuade his people and their ostensible allies on the other side, our side, of the Atlantic. His solution was expressed on June 14, 1940, when he spoke again on the subject of the day. "Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight on with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old." I don't know about you, but I get chills thinking about the passion behind Churchill's righteous campaign against Hitler. His words in this speech are the perfect way to introduce the subject of pain in negotiation. With a towering passion and 179 perfectly chosen words, Churchill wanted to paint a picture for his vast audience of the pain of living under, bowing down before, abominable tyranny. He also wanted to paint a second picture, that of fighting against this abomination with, if necessary, the life of the last good man and woman on earth. His adversary was the constituency of the Western democracies, and they were never going to make the decision to go to war without a clear vision of the intolerable pain that would follow from Nazi rule. Just recently, a friend told me about a speech he'd heard by Hugh L. McCall, Jr., chairman and CEO of Bank of America, before the Economic Club in Chicago. McCall had been in banking 41 years, starting with a small one in North Carolina, building what is now Bank of America. A member of the audience asked how McCall had successfully negotiated over 100 mergers and acquisitions, and he answered, "I really try to get inside their head before I ever get in the room with them." Exactly. And what was McCall looking for inside the adversary's head? The pain, to use my nomenclature. As a negotiator, you can and will make a lot of mistakes, of course, but your clear vision of your adversary's pain will see you through thick and thin. As I stated earlier, adhering to your mission and purpose will keep you from going seriously astray in a negative direction. Now you have a tool for keeping you oriented in a positive direction. Your vision of your adversary's pain. With both mission and purpose and pain, you're in great shape. But without both, you're wandering in the desert. One day quite a few years ago, my son Jim and I were tooling along on an errand for my wife Patty in Dublin, Ohio, where we lived. That's a suburb of Columbus. When we passed the local exotic car dealership, just as one of those transport trucks was unloading some new Porsches, one of these beauties was flaming red with a black convertible top. Light rain had moistened the top and beaded on the body. Now the sun was out and that car was glistening. "Jimbo," I exclaimed, "look at that. Porsche doesn't make a convertible. They only build T-tops and coupes. Where did this convertible come from? I'll bet someone had it built by special order. There couldn't be another one like it in Ohio, much less here in Dublin." I ended up buying that car. Why? The picture I had of myself as the only guy in Ohio with this magnificent Porsche cruising down the road in that machine on a sunny day with the top down and with heads turned wherever I went. My pain was my ego trip, my vanity. I ached for this car. Okay, no harm in falling into the position of needing a car. Silly, maybe, but not all that harmful. But in a negotiation, pain is big-time serious. This is why I use that harsh word, to emphasize the seriousness of the concept. In every negotiation, pain is what brings the negotiator to the table in the first place. It is, in effect, the soft underbelly in his negotiating position, the most vulnerable point. Your pain in a negotiation can be your need to put this particular machine on your factory floor and not one of the competitive products. But maybe you don't know that you need this particular machine. Maybe all you understand is that you need a pretty good machine. My primary job in this negotiation is to create vision of your real pain, that this is the only machine for your purposes, that this technology is the future of this industry, and that without it, your efficiency and your business plan will suffer. Meanwhile, my own pain in this negotiation is that my company has committed 60% of its resources to the development of this machine, and we want to establish it as the new industry standard. Our adversaries, if they're on top of things, will make sure that we know that they know that we've bet the farm on this machine. They'll have found this out through research, of course. Other scenarios. Your pain can be your desire to hire this particular person, who's head and shoulders above any other candidate you've interviewed. Or on the other side, it can be your desire as the applicant to get this particular job because the salary is twice what you're making now. Or the pain can be your desire as an editor to buy a particular manuscript from an author because it's the best airport novel you've read in years. Or it can be your burning desire to sell this airport novel for major money because you've gone through your life's meager savings while writing it for the past 2 years. It can be your desire to sell this Porsche today, not tomorrow. Or it can be your desire to be the only big shot in Ohio driving this model. It can be a dance company's need to book this gig because they need the revenue and it fills out the schedule. Or it can be the need of the performing arts theater to fill in the blank on their own schedule. It can be the football player's burning desire to play for a top program, or it can be the desire of the coach of the top program to get this particular kid for his team. And in his negotiation with his people, Winston Churchill had his own pain as well. His picture of what failure meant, not to him personally, but to Western Europe and beyond. In the political and moral realm, you could almost define leadership as the effective painting of the pain shared by leader and people. Think of Lincoln. He had to share with his constituents his own picture of the pain that would follow if the Union were allowed to disintegrate. Of course, Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln were two of the greatest men who ever lived. Each understood in his horror, his gut, that all meaningful actions and decisions begin with a vision. Without the vision each painted with his incomparable words, there would have been no decisive action by the people. We more limited individuals could do worse than learn from Lincoln and Churchill. In a really efficient negotiation, both parties will work to clarify the vision of the pain of the adversary. In any event, you must never enter a negotiation in which you haven't seen your adversary's pain. Never. In fact, if your mission and purpose is set in the world of the adversary, and it is, of course, then the features and benefits of what you offer in this negotiation will necessarily be addressed to the pain in the adversary's world. That said, you must never forget to blank slate and make certain that there's no hidden pain that you haven't discovered and that is subverting the entire deal. In many cases, the pain will be pretty straightforward and the issues pretty clear, but sometimes you really have to dig. The purchase of life insurance comes to mind. I can think of a simple reason someone might give the salesman setting up an appointment. Well, I guess my wife and kids just need some life insurance. But I can see that hidden behind this general emotion could be a host of particular circumstances, and it would be the particular circumstance, not the general emotion, that generates the deal in the end. You may have to really hunt for the pain. In most cases in which you have an intractable problem in a negotiation, either you failed to help your adversary understand his pain, or you failed to have a clear vision of the pain, or the real pain is actively hidden. In big corporate negotiations, imagine the different people and their private agendas in which the real pain would be carefully camouflaged. Divisions within a large corporation will even hide their pain from other divisions within the same corporation, common bureaucratic behavior, much less from negotiators for other companies. Negotiators definitely don't hang the pain out for just anyone to look at. Well, occasionally they do, but probably they don't, and great professional negotiators never will. People, negotiators, have to feel safe in order to reveal their pain, and perhaps even to see it clearly themselves. They definitely will not expose their pain if they think the adversary will try to take advantage of them. Who would? So your challenge as a negotiator is to discover and paint for your adversary the clearest possible picture of their pain while always nurturing. According to family tradition, my great-grandfather used to say about one of the mules on his farm, to get his attention, you have to hit him between the eyes with a 2x4. When you have his attention, he can see what he ought to do. But this doesn't work with us humans. We can be just as lacking in vision as mules, but we will not usually respond to the 2x4. You want your human adversaries to see the pain, but you don't want to hit them between the eyes with it. You soften the blow, so to speak, with nurturing. A classic example of how a clear vision of a hidden pain revealed by nurturing drives the decision-making process involved a client who was trying to acquire a much smaller company whose founder had recently died. However, the asking price per share for the company in play was 3 times the true market value of the stock. The price was so inflated that it made no sense. My client simply couldn't understand why the adversary would take such a risk with such a high asking price. Obviously, my client didn't have a clue when it came to the adversary's real pain. As it turned out, the widow of the founder of that company belonged to the same club as one of my client's board members, whose wife often played cards with the widow. One day at the club, the board member's wife chatted up the widow and asked how she was able to face dealing with all the details involving her late husband's company. The board member's wife asked this interrogative-led question, how, in such a nurturing way that the widow spilled her beans. She revealed that the sale of her late husband's company represented, in her mind, the end of her husband's legacy, and she felt he would be forgotten. Her husband had been an inventor, and she was desperately trying to find a way to immortalize him, especially for her many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The board member's wife was able to set up a meeting between the widow and my client. The mission and purpose of that meeting for my client? To get the woman to see and describe what was most important to her and her family in this acquisition. My client explained to her that the two companies were so far apart in price that the difference could never be overcome. He asked her what he could do. "How can I help you?" he asked. For a second time, the widow spilled the beans and told my client about her fear of her husband's legacy disappearing. My client asked her if she'd ever thought of erecting a memorial on the grounds of his company to recognize and honor his achievements. She was absolutely flabbergasted. My client added that if he made this acquisition, his company would be pleased to establish and pay for the memorial. She could choose the artist and the material and design the memorial in any way that she wanted. She accepted this offer almost on the spot, and within 6 months, the acquisition was completed. My client had finally learned the real pain at the heart of the negotiation, and then had helped the woman see this pain in her own mind and proposed a way for her to alleviate it. Turn on the Discovery Channel, I like to say. Paint the pain. When you finally get to the right person in a negotiation, they will often spill the beans and reveal their real pain so that you can fix it. That target company had valued itself at something approaching $100 million, ridiculous as we knew, but my client's board of directors eventually authorized $50 million for the purchase. In the end, they paid less than $25 million. And don't forget to nurture. I have a number of clients in the digital world where change comes so fast a company can find itself behind the eight ball almost overnight. If it can happen to Microsoft, it can happen to anyone. If you're convinced that a potential customer has taken a potentially fatal fork in the road, and you know that you have the means to help them correct that mistake, how in the world do you go about painting this terrible pain? How do you tell a company that's invested tens of millions of dollars that they've got to turn their supertanker on a dime, and quickly? You certainly can't say, "Folks, you've just wasted $30 million and several years' work by 20 good people. That's the bad news. The good news is that our technology can bail you out." That won't get you anywhere. You can't challenge all the time and money that the company has invested in a misguided direction without nurturing. Without careful nurturing, the vision your adversaries will have is that they're incompetent losers and that their heads will soon be rolling. Only with the most careful nurturing and with the most careful painting of the pain will they see and accept the merits of the correct vision, and see and decide that going in another direction is the only way for long-term success. So, you say, "Now, I ask you to be patient with me here, but I've got a real problem. Maybe I'm out of my mind. I need you to tell me if I am. Just say so. And everything I say is going to sound self-serving. I understand that. But with your permission, I'd like to tell you what I see, and together, let's see if it makes sense." But you don't describe your vision at all. Instead, you ask a series of interrogative-led questions to build their vision. The first question is, what direction is this whole industry now going in the area of wireless widgets? You've nurtured. You've given the adversary permission to say no, and you will use the 3-plus technique. This is how you start building for your adversary his vision of his own pain, which in this case he isn't hiding and doesn't even know. By the way, the he here is not some hypothetical adversary. This was an actual meeting between the president of one of my clients and the president of a major corporation heading for serious trouble. When you begin in any new negotiation or find yourself losing control of an ongoing negotiation, you return to what? Your mission and purpose. And where is your mission and purpose set? In your adversary's world. And what is embedded deep within your adversary's world? Their pain. When in doubt, return to the pain, and always nurture, because without it, the pain may be simply too much. Gee, that's a bad break. How long will your car be in the shop? That's terrible. How long will your company pay for the temporary apartment? This is a great technology. You must really have invested a lot in it. Sure, we have a lot of competitors, so you're in good shape in that regard. Now, when do you need to get your line back up and running? The clearer your adversary's vision of his pain, the easier the decision-making process. This may sound like one of the more counterintuitive aspects of my system of negotiation, but think about it this way. If your doctor doesn't paint for you a crystal-clear picture of your case, your pain, will she ever be able to sell you this medicine or this outpatient procedure, much less this 3-hour operation? Somehow I rather doubt it. I think about this psychological issue every time I see another advertisement in the anti-smoking campaign. How long have we been funding these programs now? How effective have they been, especially the ones aimed at kids? Even granting that they've helped a little, and I think this would be hard to prove, clearly they're not really effective. Why not? They've not been able to successfully paint a vision of the pains of smoking, the hacking cough, the odors, the cost, the public disapproval in some circles, and the possibility of cancer, clearly enough to offset the pleasures and, of course, the addiction. Painting pain is not creating pain. I hope it's understood that I'm not talking about creating pain in your adversary. Many times I've heard someone say, "Boy, did I put them in pain." That's ridiculous. You help create the vision, but you don't create the pain itself at all. The pain is just there. The doctor doesn't create your pain. She helps you see your case clearly. The retail salesperson isn't starting from scratch. My son Jim and I didn't wander onto the parking lot of the Porsche dealership by accident. I wanted that cabriolet badly. No salesman in the world was going to be able to convince me that I had an aching need I didn't really have. Likewise, no one wanders into an electronics store intent on buying a new refrigerator. The salesperson always has something to work with. And it wasn't as if Churchill had nothing to work with in his negotiation with his constituents. Western Europe and the United States did need to gear up for a war with Hitler. The British certainly knew the dangers posed by Hitler. They just needed their vision and the solution painted with passion. Americans were a little slower on the uptake, but that was natural. We were far away and justifiably sick of European wars, but we too could finally be stirred to action by the combined efforts of Churchill and Roosevelt to paint with passion both the vision and the solution. So please, forget any idea you may have about creating pain for your adversary. That's amateur hour. What you help create is their vision of their very real pain. The difference is huge, and you shouldn't read further until you're convinced I'm right about this. As a negotiator, you want the adversary to see and understand his pain calmly and rationally, just as you have long ago seen and understood your own pain, calmly and rationally. For example, am I wrong in presuming that you're reading this book because you have some kind of modest pain in the area of negotiation? If you seem to be mired in an intractable problem in a negotiation, it's not because you haven't been able to create some pain. As I said earlier, you either don't have a clear vision of your adversary's pain, or you haven't been able to paint the picture clearly for your adversary, or the adversary doesn't even see their own pain. "Oh, come on," you may blurt. But it's true. Sometimes the adversary just doesn't get it. "But wouldn't this be good?" new clients have asked. If I figure out their pain and they don't, doesn't this put me one up? Doesn't it allow me to sneak up on them? No, this is poppycock. It's not real world. If the company on the other side of the table doesn't understand that they need your machine and no other machine, what's their incentive in the negotiation? If the real estate agent doesn't understand that this lunar-powered house in the middle of the lake is so quirky very few people will be interested, where's the incentive to come down from the ridiculous asking price? You think anyone's going to make a deal without a very clear vision of why they need to make this deal? Please. Their ignorance of their pain only puts everybody one down. If they don't know their own pain, they'll never make the deal. Two competitors were trying to sell an apparently comparable piece of equipment to a third company. One's price was $2.9 million. The other's was $2.1 million. There was only one difference in the machines, which no one knew about at the beginning of the negotiations. The more expensive machine could be configured so that it would provide much longer service than the inexpensive machine. This longer service life was much more valuable than the $800,000 difference in the cost, but unbelievably perhaps, the buyer had failed to understand this basic point. When we were able to get the purchaser to see clearly their future pain if they purchased the less expensive machine, to see that this had become a situation of pay me now or pay me later, they eagerly purchased the more expensive machine. Another more detailed story that vividly demonstrates the power of painting the real pain is the second installment of the Network Incorporated saga. You may recall from the first installment, related in Chapter 2, that the company had gotten itself into a serious bind thanks to terrible negotiating that had produced contracts under which it was losing $100,000 on every machine shipped to its primary customer. But they had kept shipping for fear of losing this account and going out of business. Of course, losing money on every machine would also put them out of business, just more slowly. This situation played out during a downturn in the industry some years ago. Up against the wall at last, the network board was prepared to shut down if one more machine was shipped at this losing price. The president was instructed to renegotiate or cancel the deal with a major European conglomerate. The negotiators on the other side were real tigers. Their entire strategy for every negotiation was to play the win-win game, bludgeon their win-win adversaries, and drive down every price from their many suppliers. And they were successful in doing so. They'd certainly succeeded against Network. Several members of the Network team were completely cowed by these negotiators, who, they were convinced, would get angry and walk away if Network tried to change its losing situation into a profitable one by renegotiating. In fact, these folks lost their jobs because they refused to go along with the new negotiating system I was coaching. But the president was ready to try anything. We were short of time, so I worked intensely with the president, and he controlled his team accordingly. They'd been introduced to my methods, but that was about all. They weren't really trained. But we forged ahead because we had no choice. 7 days before Network was supposed to ship the first machine in a large order signed 8 months earlier, we set up a conference call among 13 negotiators in 6 countries. My client, Network's president, opened with minimal pleasantries because this was an ultra-serious phone call. Nothing could be allowed to distract them from that. His statement was short, concise, and direct. Our problem is that we want to be your supplier of the future. We want to be the provider of technology that takes you into the 21st century. But we must alert you that we cannot ship the machines currently under order to you because we're losing $100,000 per machine. We're in a desperate situation. We simply cannot ship the machines. The president closed his remarks by apologizing for putting the other company in this position, which, as a professional businessman, he would never do if it weren't a matter of his company's survival. If Network didn't survive, there wouldn't be any machines to ship at any price. It's important to see that he did not explicitly paint the adversary's pain, but he didn't have to. By describing the desperate situation, by saying, "No, we cannot deliver these machines at this price," he made it easy for the adversary to discover and feel his own current and future pain should he say no in return. Often, there is no more effective way to paint the adversary's pain than by asking them to tell you no. When your adversary carefully considers exactly what this no entails, their pain becomes very clear indeed, and good things can happen for you. In this negotiation, the adversary had its very low price for the machines, but now there were consequences. First, they wouldn't get the equipment, and they did need these machines, which were state-of-the-art, the very best. Second, they were in danger of driving this technically superior supplier out of business. Third, if they succeeded in doing this, they'd lose their effective dual-vendor strategy in negotiations. Given that there were only 2 suppliers of this vital equipment, the loss of one would mean they'd have no leverage with the remaining supplier. They'd put themselves at the mercy of the other supplier, in fact, whose machine was technically inferior to boot. Then, where would their vaunted cost optimization strategies leave them? I'm sure the adversary's negotiators understood all this in a flash after the statement from the network president. You cannot tell anyone anything. Rather than set out on the sometimes long, hard road of painting vision and pain, many negotiators make the fatal mistake of thinking they can convince someone to make the rational decision to do something, to buy something, to see something the same way they see it. They offer up reasons, facts, figures, and charm that they are sure would make any rational person see things the way they see them. In fact, most negotiators think of the gift of gab as one of their greatest assets. But what's the problem with trying to convince someone to see the same thing you see? You know the answer to this question, but let's go ahead and spell it out. To begin with, you're asking your adversary to come into your world and to see your world. And where do we want to spend our time in a negotiation? In the adversary's world. Second, if we're busy giving reasons to our adversary, we're too busy talking. We're totally in our world and impeding our ability to blank slate. Finally, the most important of all, we're forgetting that decisions are made not with our head, but with our heart and guts, first of all. Remember, negotiations are 100% emotional until a decision is made. You cannot tell anyone anything. Think about this, and be sure you agree with me. You can only help people see for themselves. To test this thesis, a clever client once devised a clever experiment. He was making a presentation to a financial analyst, and he did it twice, in effect, once in the standard didactic way, and then a second time in which he asked questions of the analyst. In the first presentation, the analyst sat quietly and took a few notes, but the second time around, he filled page after page with notes as he engaged with the interrogatives from my client. Since that day, that particular client has understood completely the power of asking questions as a way of painting the vision, the pain, so the adversary in a negotiation sees it for his own. In trying to convince someone to buy this product or service or to sign this deal, in trying to reason with someone, we're setting ourselves up to fail. Instead, we have to use our fuels of the system, asking questions, nurturing, connecting, reversing, and more, in order to paint the picture of their pain. During the conference call I mentioned earlier, the one involving the president of Network Inc., he asked the adversary, "How do you think this problem can be solved?" An interrogative-led question, of course. In the end, the other company offered to pay Network an additional $200,000 per machine, $100,000 to reach break-even, $100,000 for profit. Moreover, they proposed to grant, not loan, but simply give Network several $1 million in order to ensure its financial stability. Sound too good to be true? Maybe, but it is true. Apparently, the Network president's presentation had given the adversary a clear picture of current and future pain if they didn't get those machines. But my client didn't accept this offer immediately. After four more meetings, they secured additional orders for more machines. Bottom line, Network had an immediate turnaround on the bottom line of tens of millions of dollars, and then secured $100 million in new orders. The switch from the old sales team to the new one took about a year and a half. The new team of seven people produced and is still producing about three times the dollar volume generated by the old team of 30 people. What better example could we find of the rule that the value of any negotiation, the price that will be paid in any negotiation, is directly related to the clarity of the vision of pain? What better example of the rule that the greater the pain, the higher the price the adversary will pay to have it made better or taken away? Now, how could the win-win paradigm have worked for beleaguered Network? It couldn't have. How in the world could the same lame negotiating style that had gotten them into this bind have gotten them out of it? Impossible. Sometimes one simple question can create a vision of the pain and quickly drive a decision. Recall the negotiation between my client and the doctors at the hospital regarding whether his baby girl would be transferred to the other hospital for surgery. My client thought this transfer was too risky. He and his wife wanted the doctors from the other hospital to perform the operation in the hospital where their baby already was. My client asked only one question of the head of the neonatal unit. "How much risk are you willing to take with my child's life?" After the father asked this interrogative-led question, the doctor considered his answer carefully. The question about the baby's pain was designed to make the doctor think about his own pain. How much risk am I willing to take to transfer this baby? To his great credit, the doctor did not shoot from the hip, know-it-all style. And though he knew nothing about my system of negotiating, he did understand that he had so far failed to paint a clear picture of my client's own pain in this situation. The doctor replied calmly that yes, there was risk in transferring the baby, and yes, there was an operating theater at the hospital, and yes, they could request the specialist from the other hospital to come over here. But, he continued, the real risk for my client's daughter was not what happened during the operation, but post-op complications. If the baby was moved to the other hospital, she would have the best care available to her within seconds should an emergency arise after the operation. If she remained in her current hospital, the best care was phone calls, beepers, pagers, and urgent car trips away. Now, the pain on both sides was very clear. My client immediately changed his mind and okayed the transfer to the other hospital. The operation was successful, and the baby is now a perfectly healthy toddler. Painting the pain is an art. Your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. I quote these words from Emerson for the second time because truer words were never written. For a negotiator, they're pure gold. The naturally glib negotiator talks too much. The brilliant negotiator tries to overpower his adversary with intelligence. The friendly, compassionate negotiator tries to save his adversary. The aggressive negotiator tries to browbeat his adversary. The list of scenarios goes on and on and on, and the painting of pain is one area in which the serious negotiator must be particularly careful not to get carried away with his or her particular strength and skill. You want to avoid that emotional pendulum I wrote about in the section on strip lines in Chapter 7. You want to avoid the too positive and the too negative. The vision has to be clear, but so does the solution you offer. You must not frighten or anger the adversary. You can't appear to be lording it over your adversary. You must nurture at all times. Painting the pain is one of the real arts of negotiation. You must wield the brush with the touch of an old master.